October 2021 and accused them of funneling donor aid to militants and had ties to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a Palestinian left-wing movement. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bisan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees.
We will continue our work. Work in this field, it's not a job. It's not a job. The Israelis continue their atrocities, their oppression against us, against the rest of the civil society organizations here. But this will not stop us, and this will not push us back, and we will not give up, and we will continue. We know that we pay price, maybe personal price, maybe different kind of a price, but we are ready to defend, to fight for the principles that we do believe.
The United Nations Human Rights Office has meanwhile expressed alarm at Israel's arbitrary closure of organizations and called on Israel to immediately reverse these decisions, reiterating the High Commissioner's call to revoke the designations of the organizations as terrorist and unlawful. The Israeli regime has added to its illegal practices which aim to silence the Palestinian people. Today, not only does it continue to suppress Palestinian people, the regime also quells these organizations and human rights advocates. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Iranian Minister for Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi, along with the delegation of 57 dignitaries from Iran, visited Islamabad on the sidelines of 21st session of Pak-Iran Joint Economic Commission. During the two-day visit, the Iranian delegation met Pakistan's Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari and discussed the bilateral ties between the two countries. Pakistan's Foreign Minister underlined the need to fully utilize the existing potential between Islamabad and Tehran in energy and air links. Addressing a press conference with the Iranian Roads and Urban Development Minister, Pakistan's Minister for Commerce, Naveed Qamar, said both sides have agreed to start negotiations on transit agreements that will allow the movement of goods without any additional taxes or tariffs.
We agreed on time frames for the PTA, which is to be negotiated between the two countries, and an ambitious target of 6 months has been set for that process.
The visiting Iranian minister, Rustam Qasimi, said the 21st session of Pakistan-Iran Joint Economic Commission offers new avenues for expanding bilateral ties between Pakistan and Iran. He noted, in order to increase bilateral trade, both sides are ready to establish border markets, which will later be made free economic zones to enable investors of both countries to set up their industries for import and export purposes.
I believe that the implementation of these agreements will play a significant role in raising the quality of life of the people of the two sides, especially the border markets, transportation, and the exchange of goods between the two countries.
Islamabad has assured Tehran that it is committed to taking all possible measures to increase bilateral trade volume to the level of $5 billion in near future.
Besides signing different MOUs in the fields of transport, trade and business, both Pakistan and Iran also stressed the need of making visa conditions easier to facilitate the traders and visitors from both sides. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
North Korea launched two cruise missiles into nearby waters early Wednesday morning, according to South Korean military officials. The missile shots follow South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's offer of substantial aid, with one condition: Pyongyang must give up its nuclear weapons program.
We will help the North every way we can. If the country shows us its commitment to complete denuclearization, I think we need to provide an agenda first so that we can wait for its answer. And this will also enable us to have meaningful talks with North Korea in the future for the establishment of peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Some South Koreans view the previous summits between progressive former President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un as empty shows for the cameras. For North Korea, the offer of aid from the conservative new President Yoon suffers from questionable timing.
Coupled with the fact that South Korea and the U.S. are about to stage war games, it seems highly unlikely that North Korea is even going to respond to South Korea's offer. The U.S. and South Korea have not staged field exercises in years, and obviously North Korea is outraged at what's going to happen.
The U.S. and South Korea have been engaging in frequent small-scale military drills since South Korean President Yoon took office. The joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to begin on August 22nd and will be the largest in about 4 years. Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. This year's maneuvers will include an amphibious landing. The upcoming drills will also involve a U.S. aircraft carrier strike group and strategic weapons. The South's Yoon also said he hoped to strengthen the U.S. extended deterrence commitment to defend South Korea with nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sizzling temperatures have cooled off in the U.K., but the inflation rate is only heating up. Prices are going up everywhere, as inflation, this time driven by food price hikes, jumps to its highest level since 1982, coming in at more than 10%. Millions of families across Britain are now trying to make their money stretch, but it's getting harder by the day.
My weekly, my monthly, everything's shop is increasing. I'm shopping right now, whilst I'm at work, to just save time. Because not only is your time money, but we don't really have much of that thing called money.
I am having to budget myself, limit myself, to try and ensure that my wage lasts the whole month, considering I'm having to pay for petrol, bills, rent. It does all add up.
It's harder for me to afford things because, you know, I don't have the steady income like most people do in London.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect inflation storm caused by a number of factors. Brexit and the delays and disruptions it has caused to the supply chain, the pandemic, and the ongoing Western-backed war in Ukraine.
The UK economy reopened suddenly after COVID, creating bottlenecks at ports compounded by post-Brexit red tape, followed by astronomical energy prices resulting from a decision to wean the UK from Russian energy. Inside the UK, that has translated into higher transport and packaging costs, soaring energy and food prices. That means bills getting more and more expensive in supermarkets, restaurants, and gas stations, feeding the demand for higher pay, which adds further to business costs, which turns into even higher prices. And it is that demand for wage increases that's seen multiple public sector strikes in recent weeks. It's a worsening mess that some economists say is in large part the UK government's own doing.
The answer is the war in Ukraine. And you will say, well, is the war in Ukraine going to come to an end? And the answer is no, not if the UK government can help it. You see, Western foreign policy is involved in another debacle.
All this at a time when the UK awaits a new prime minister. Whoever they may be, they have their job cut out for them. Sai Puriza, London.
A year ago, the United States marked a chaotic end to 20 years of war in Afghanistan, following a hurried pullout of troops that saw the Taliban reclaiming power in the country. Here in Tehran, Iranian officials and political analysts sat together to discuss different aspects of the incident. They regard Washington's exit as an escape from the Afghan quagmire after it failed to achieve its geostrategic objectives there.
Today, the significance of Afghanistan has not diminished in the eyes of the Americans. They didn't leave the country to let China, Russia, and Iran invest in it. The U.S. had to leave because it totally failed there. But it will continue to make the best of its efforts to destabilize Afghanistan.
Last year, in late August, the U.S. evacuated thousands of troops from Afghanistan in just a few days, following President Joe Biden's order to exit fully by August 30, 2021. The withdrawal marked the end of two decades of war in Afghanistan, which sought to bring peace to the country, but left a trail of chaos and mayhem.
The United States not only did not fight terrorism during its two decades of presence in Afghanistan, but had a role in many acts of terrorism to legitimize and prolong its presence there.
1 year after the U.S. pullout, Afghanistan is still bogged down in turmoil. The country has been the scene of recurrent terrorist attacks, some of which have been claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Iran says the U.S. has resorted to Daesh to wage a proxy war in Afghanistan to make up for its losses.
The U.S. continues to back terrorists such as Daesh to destabilize Afghanistan. Aside from Daesh, it has been hosting some 7,000 Afghan military forces from the previous Afghan army to train them. What's the goal of such military trainings?
Since the Taliban takeover, Iran has been calling for an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan as the ultimate way out of the persisting instability in the war-torn country.
Experts here describe the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan a lasting shame for America and the worst fiasco after its loss in the 1950s Vietnam War. They say the chaotic exit is also a lesson for the region that wherever Washington has set foot, it has left nothing but mess and destruction for the hosting nations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives or who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory.
Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, Give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Operation against Ukraine continues. This is while the U.S. military support also continues unabated, with the latest support equaling almost another $1 billion. Meanwhile, sanctions and condemnations against Russia have never stopped. For example, the U.K. has stated that Russia has no moral right to sit at the Group of 20 Nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at where things stand, especially when it comes to the battered European economies, many facing energy shortfalls, or majority of them, coming before the upcoming winter season ahead. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. From the International Action Center, Sarah Flounders joins us from New York. Also joining us is contributor at the Schiller Institute, Karel Veriken, who joins us from Paris.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Sarah Flounders, let me first start with you. Trying to keep up with the pace, let alone the numbers, in terms of the dollar amount from the U.S. in the form of military support for Ukraine. Another one, $775 million, $9 billion since the conflict began, and is part of a huge $40 or $50 billion military package. What do you make of this massive military support that the U.S. is sending, which is said to be a largest arms transfer in U.S. history by some accounts?
Is this to me?
Yes, Sarah Flounders.
Well, it is an enormous, enormous subsidy to U.S. arms manufacturers. That's what it is, first and foremost. It's not meant in any defense of the people of Ukraine, who are being used as pawns in a proxy war. And it is devastating for them. It's also devastating right back here. But it is a U.S. instigated effort to recap their hegemony in the world, which is rapidly fading. And so they are willing to pump billions and billions of dollars, which are payments, as I say, to the military industries here at great profit, and ship some of it. A lot of it just gets lost, resold, repackaged, but some of it gets shipped to the Ukraine. And at the same time, it is creating enormous economic hardship in Europe, because the sanctions, which go right along with the weapons packages, are devastating throughout the world. And it's meant to create hardship, but that is what the U.S. is willing to do in an effort to recapture its position.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Carell, if we can, about what the U.S. has sent in this latest batch. And I'm particularly zooming in on these launchers by the name of HIMARS, which are not the typical, launch vehicles that were used prior, but now recently the U.S. has actually sent it as part of their military package, 16 to be the latest batch, because the U.S. has actually limited that number, fearing that it's going to maybe lead to the U.S. endangering its own national security. It's pretty astounding that the U.S. is going to such limits to provide Ukraine with military assistance, isn't it, when it's looking at equipment that may actually endanger U.S.'s own national security?
Well, it does, because many wars, world wars, can also start very easily by errors of evaluation. And, of course, the French Caesar cannons are already a problem, although their reach is a little bit shorter. The HIMARS, and also the, especially because they imply a lot of intelligence and assistance with radar equipment, and they're in reality, according to certain sources, there have been already strikes of by these weapon system on Russian territory itself, and then also in Crimea, which Ukraine will still pretend it is part of Ukraine, while in reality Crimea has decided to join the Russian Federation. So it is an escalation towards making Russia and also Europe co-belligerent actors in the war. And it is only the cold blood, the calculation of the Russian military, which so far has kept things on a low level. Also, the HIMARS was used to eliminate the about 100, or at least half of the 100 arrested military forces of the Azov Brigade, which were in a special prison, and which, of course, were not eliminated by the Russians themselves, because they were set to speak before the tribunal and to tell what really happened, and they most probably, most likely, were eliminated with a strike from a missile to prevent them from speaking up.
All right, there's something that's really I'm not too sure what to make of it. I'm going to call it, in a sense, shocking, Sarah Flounders, that came from the Pentagon. And I'd like to find out if you can make this out. The Pentagon has come out within the same setting, saying that right now, there, according to the statement, a complete and total lack of progress has been made by the Russians on the battlefield. But then the same organization, the person from the Pentagon, has said, when pressed by the reporters, that the Ukrainians lacked sufficient troops and combat power to drive the Russians from their defensive positions. This is a complete contradiction and contrast to the stance that the Pentagon has claimed within one setting. What do you make of it?
Well, I think I would make the same thing. Were the statements any different on Afghanistan right until the day before the U.S. was driven out? They were winning. They claimed it again and again in every public relations statement, and they demanded that Afghan officials also say the situation is being reversed. Didn't mean that it was. And so we've always seen this declaration of victory being just around the corner, when in fact, that's not what's happening. And as long as they can sell the weapons, pump the weapons in, as far as they are concerned, they're winning. They must find wars in order to make the super profits that the military industries are really built on. And they must justify the wars. So that really becomes a self-perpetuating claim. And it is very difficult to know what's actually happening from anything in the U.S. media, because they intentionally don't explain the reason for the war and what's happening on the ground. And at the same time, they claim to care a great deal about the people of the Ukraine. They really are into totally using the people of the Ukraine and organizing and funding for years fascist or Nazi forces in the Ukraine.
Carell, if I can ask you about this, it's almost the same question, but when we look at the numbers and the different analysis on Ukraine's military might, there seems to be consensus on the fact that there's not enough manpower to defend Ukraine or to even be offensive against Russia, but that Ukraine needs equipment. The president has said that. So this kind of puts the focus on the equipment side of things. But we're talking about nuclear-powered Russia. The president has said, Vladimir Putin, nuclear weapons will not be used. But if pressed, and especially if they're looking after Crimea in what's supposed to be this big counteroffensive, do you think there's a possibility that that risks Russia using nuclear weapons of some kind?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to really predict that this will happen or not. It is, in reality, what Sarah Flanders is saying is true. We're all being lied already on the initial strategy of Russia. Russia never intended to, and that's why they say it's a military operations, because in reality they don't want to invade the entirety of Ukraine and occupy it for forever. You know, that's not absolutely not their aim. Secondly, according to the best estimates from the French military and U.S. military, it's there are three times more Ukrainian soldiers than Russian soldiers. So it's a pure lie to say that in terms of numbers, Ukrainians have much more people, which they are very badly trained and low qualified, but they have more people. That's true. And Russia is just taking time to let things work out and is expecting that at one point or another it will be very simply things will run out. And there is an inside division in the U.S., as we have seen with the declaration of Henry Kissinger, which is not my favorite at all, but who is somehow a realist, including a realist for U.S. strategic interests, where he said, you know, that Biden administration is bringing the U.S. in a war with Russia and China into things which the U.S. has partly played on, but nobody knows how this is going to end. So even people like Kissinger, which are not real humanists, you know, are afraid that this whole thing could go out of control, and that at one point or another, yesterday there was a call by former U.S. military, the most lunatic elements, which were calling for increased weaponry and increasing, it's not only the quantity, but increasingly more offensive weapons. And that will at one point be used directly against Belarus and Russia. And at that point, then, of course, indeed, Russia could use nuclear strike as an answer. So this is, we're sleepwalking into a big conflict if there is no wake-up call to get this thing under control.
Our guest talks about how things are getting to the point where it's out of control, Sarah Flanders. But aren't things out of control right now when you're looking at, for example, incidents concerns Germany, where Gazprom has again announced another halt to its gas flow to Germany? Reports of Germany being deindustrialized and that they need to ration electricity. I mean, that to me sounds like things have gotten out of control just on one European country. What do you think?
Well, things are certainly out of control within the European economy. Britain also. They're feeling the impact of the sanctions that have boomeranged back on them. It's also hitting here, not as sharply right now, but we're feeling it also. Russia, who is self-sufficient in grain, in energy, in cereals, and a lot of resources, and a great deal of industrial infrastructure, is able to survive these very harsh sanctions and is setting up new banking transactions with other countries. On the other hand, the European Union suddenly finds itself without energy that they absolutely need to fuel their industries and homes and heating and air conditioning and everything that you need in summer and winter. And every single country is feeling the shortages with crazy messages to the populations to shower less and turn out your lights and so on. This won't solve the problems in Europe, but it really means that the sanctions are coming back and hitting them hard because they don't have an alternative to the gas and the oil that they previously exported and used in great quantity and at great advantageous to their own industries. And this is what the U.S. wants to break, because there was 10 times more trade, for example, between Germany and Russia than with the U.S. Well, they want to reverse that and close the door on trade with Russia. It is devastating for the German economy and most of the other countries in Europe that are going along with the sanctions.
Still don't understand how this can actually happen, Carel, when we take a look at the fact that there are still European countries that are purchasing gas and oil from Russia. Germany is still doing that. The Netherlands is still doing that. There are many others that are still doing that with that scheme of how they need to, exchange the euros into rubles and deposit it in one of the Russian banks, Gazprom, I believe. So, you know, that doesn't go with the way that the EU is promoting its all-out sanctions war with Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, it's... And it reveals the completely hypocritical system which this EU has become, because they are facing, officially they want to have an embargo, but in practice it will take months and years. And even then, you know, we have, there's a lot of oil bought from India, which is shipped somewhere else, and then it ends up even back in the United States, you know. So the whole facade of things. I mean, this is the craziness of things. They decide things which are absolutely impossible to put into practice, and because they, for example, Renault, you know, the French car industry, they sold their assets for a symbolical sum of money, sold it to the Russians, but they have a special deal that they can buy it back for the same price in the next 6 years, because they expect at that point, you know, maybe the war will be ended and things could be back to normal. So there is a real clash between the political elites, which are completely insane, and the other on the side, the real people and the economic interests, even the which are really in shock, and also because the sanctions will not only hit Europe, but a lot of countries to which Europe, if you take, for example, Cambodia, you know, they buy 60%. If they have to apply the sanctions, you know, this will completely screw up supply lines for the entire Western economy. So it's, and I'm not even speaking about the food riots, which can happen any day at this point.
August 18, 2022, Sarah Flanders, Diplomacy Watch. Talks to end the war are back on the agenda. This is what one of the headline reads, confirmed by some other ones. However, actions speak louder than words when you hear about the $785 million of weaponry that the U.S. sold. Doesn't sound like diplomacy is back on the agenda or on the table. But in the bigger picture, 6 months, how much diplomacy was on that scale on the left, and how much military talk of war was on the other side of the scale? Why isn't there such a push for a diplomatic solution to this conflict, do you think?
Well, frankly, the U.S. is not interested in a diplomatic solution anywhere in the world, and every treaty, every agreement they have ever made, they have violated. This is true whether it's Iran or Russia or China or the indigenous nations of the U.S. or the countries of Latin America. They do use diplomacy from time to time, but only in terms of aggressively planning the next wars. And their interest, their bottom line interest, is in using their military and economic power to maintain their world domination. That is what is slipping, because countries around the world have reached a certain industrial and technical capacity to trade and exchange with each other. That is a big change. Before this, the dollar was all powerful, and there was no way, once you were cut off from the SWIFT banking, to do some of the simplest transactions. But now, countries have found there's all forms of digital currency. In China with the SWIFT, the CIPS, in Russia with the SPSF, there's mere credit cards. There's all kinds of ways that countries are finding to arrange exchanges for the resources that they need outside of the sanctions that are being imposed by the U.S. as an effort to shut this down. They want each country on their own to starve. That is the purpose of sanctions, is to inflict the greatest pain on the civilian population. And countries are finding ways to survive, to exchange, to trade with each other. And it's the sanctioned countries that are actually showing the way, showing that they can survive, determination internally, and exchange with each other.
Along those lines, Correll, the news came out today that Russia will move away from the dollar, euro, and SWIFT in its trade with partners, as it stated. And it said it's something that has been going on for quite some time. Many people don't realize Russia was actually under heavy sanctions that really initiated back in 2014 by the U.S., and then some European countries followed. How much longer will this take? And are we looking at the BRICS countries as an example, and then for other countries that are in the China-Russia camp to really get this trade going in their national currencies, which obviously will impact the U.S. dollar and its status one form or another?
Well, Lyndon LaRouche, with which I worked over a long period, was very much interested in this process, especially since 1971, when the U.S. Suspended the convertibility of the dollar to gold. And then there was first in Europe with the European snake, a defensive mechanism to be sheltered and to be protected against a dollar, which became a dollar of the international speculative caste, which is not anymore a dollar of the U.S. as such. It's run by an international banksters and not anymore one country as such. But now it was very interesting that including Iran has been proposing to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to find new ways to build a basket of physical goods, which could be the basis for a new monetary system. So there's first an increase, a move out of the IMF system,
okay,
or you can call it move out of the dollar.
All right.
Increase of mutual trade between Russia, India, Iran, especially through the north-south transport corridor, which is very important. A new trade route opening up. And then in the next phase, this could actually become some kind of new monetary system or a new Bretton Woods, not any longer based on the dollar, but based on an agreement among countries for mutual development.
I'd like to give you just 30 seconds, please, Sarah Flounders. What has the U.S. gained from this when Russia just came out and said it will be selling its arms that it finds significantly superior to Western arms to its allies? Doesn't that endanger U.S. national security in some sense by this move? 30 seconds, please.
Well, all of this endangers the security of the entire globe. It's very short-sighted, immediate decisions for what's the most immediately profitable, and we pay the long-term costs.
Very well.
So stay up and finding new ways to resist.
Thank you.
More important.
Thank you for that. I'm sorry to jump in. Sarah Flounders, International Action Center, Karel Barik, again, I'm a contributor of the Schiller Institute. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tahwi. It's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight. In Britain, former Cabinet Minister Michael Gove says he does not expect to return to front bench politics as he backs the underdog in the race for a new Prime Minister. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's political correspondent Peter Walker. The piece is titled "Gove Backs Sunak and Says Truss is Taking Holiday from Reality." In Britain, former Cabinet Minister Michael Gove has thrown his support behind Rishi Sunak in the Conservative leadership contest, warning that Liz Truss's refusal to offer more support over rising energy bills and to just focus on tax cuts marked a holiday from reality. In a sometimes hard-hitting article in The Times, Michael Gove said he did not expect to be made a minister again and that many people expected Liz Truss to win, but he believes Rishi Sunak makes the right arguments. Arguing that millions of people and huge numbers of businesses could be financially crippled by high energy costs, Michael Gove wrote that it was vital the new government had a coherent economic plan. And here I am deeply concerned that the framing of the leadership debate by many has been a holiday from reality, he said. The answer to the cost of living crisis cannot be simply to reject further handouts and cut tax, he wrote, a reference to Liz Truss's insistence that she would reduce national insurance contributions and resist most forms of direct help. Proposed cuts to national insurance would favour the wealthy, and changes to corporation tax apply to big businesses, not small entrepreneurs. I cannot see how safeguarding the stock options of FTSE 100 executives should ever take precedence over supporting the poorest in our society. But at a time of want, it cannot be the right priority. Michael Gove added, in contrast, I believe Rishi Sunak makes the right arguments. The endorsement of the former Community Secretary Michael Gove, a Conservative big hitter who has spent over a decade in the Cabinet under David Cameron, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, will be a blow to Liz Truss, even if it is unlikely to revive Rishi Sunak's campaign. Michael Gove had initially endorsed Kemi Badenoch, with whom he worked in the Communities Department, but who was knocked out as MPs whittled the field to contenders down to the final two. Saying Liz Truss, who was a junior minister with him in the Education Department, is tenacious, brave, and has a huge appetite for policy detail, Michael Gove said she had also been admirably clear, consistent, and principled in the case that she has made during the leadership race. He went on, "But I do not think her prospectus is the right answer for the world that we face. It does not address the fundamental problems of potential neglected, productivity suppressed, and the vulnerable suffering the most." In endorsing Rishi Sunak, Michael Gove is less likely to win a place in Liz Truss's cabinet, despite his experience and his record as a trusted minister. "I do not expect to be in the government again," Michael Gove wrote. "But it was the privilege of my life to spend 11 years in the cabinet under three prime ministers. I know what the job requires, and Rishi Sunak has it." Liz Truss, meanwhile, has been accused of holding up publication of the Foreign Office's annual human rights report because it is likely to contain criticisms of Rwanda's human rights record. This year's version of the annual assessment of how the United Kingdom views other countries' human rights records was due before the parliamentary summer recess and is now the most delayed report since the review was launched by the then Foreign Secretary Robin Cook 21 years ago. Critics say the impasse could be an attempt to quash criticism of Rwanda, to which the government wants to deport migrants and asylum seekers, or because Liz Truss is focused on the Conservative leadership race, where she is the clear favourite over Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak insisted on Thursday, 18th of August, he still has a shot of being Prime Minister, despite a new opinion poll saying Liz Truss has a 32 percentage point lead as the contest enters its final fortnight. The YouGov opinion poll with Sky News found Liz Truss had 66% of members backing her, with 34% backing Rishi Sunak, excluding Don't Knows. The former Chancellor sought to reinvigorate his campaign with another flurry of policy announcements centred around a plan to improve the National Health Service dental services, including a program of early intervention checkups in primary schools. During the leadership contest, Liz Truss has said she supports and would extend a controversial Rwanda policy. Court papers arising from proceedings to block the plan have showed that the UK's High Commissioner to Rwanda warned against the scheme because the nation has been accused of recruiting refugees to conduct armed operations in neighbouring countries. The delayed Foreign Office Human Rights Report would be expected to include further criticisms of Rwanda. The last edition, published in July of 2021, said that critical voices continued to face heavy restrictions in the country. It also condemned the death in police custody of a reconciliation activist, Kizito Mihigo.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.